Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is its fourth series. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We welcome your feedback. The novel The Wall, Die Wand in German, was first published in 1963 by the Austrian author Marlene Haushofer. In the narrative, a woman goes to the countryside with two of her relatives. Later that day, the relatives go to an inn nearby, but don't return that night. The following day, the woman goes looking for them and comes upon an impenetrable wall that she can see through. On the other side, everything she could see is dead. The wall marks her isolation, but with her are a number of animals. In many ways, the novel can be read as a story about the relationship between humans and animals, and indeed, allegorically understood, it might be thought that the wall also symbolizes the barrier between humans and animals. In this podcast, I discuss Haushofer's The Wall with Dr. Anna Richards, senior lecturer in the School of Creative Arts, Culture and Communication at Birkbeck. Among her many publications is The Friendship of Our Distant Relations, Feminism and Animal Families in Marlene Haushofer's Die Wand, published in Feminist German Studies in 2020. I won't say more about the plot now, as that comes up in my discussion with Anna, but it's worth noting this. For a novel that is over 60 years old, published by an Austrian author who lived in a very different time, I think this novel really speaks to our current moment of environmental degradation and catastrophe, and various crises around the emergence of new technologies. Our current predicament should provoke us to think about what divides us from what is called nature and animals in particular. And in so many ways, this novel speaks to that question. This is a deeply feminist novel, which picks up on questions of ecology and the ethical treatment of animals well before philosophers such as Peter Singer went on to take up these questions in the 1970s. Its conceptual range is also far richer than that of the ethicists of the 1970s, engaging with the inadequacy of human language when it comes to expressing the conundrum of relating to animals. And to my mind, this is a novel that should be placed firmly within the genre of the Robinsonade, but in this case, with a woman at the center of the narrative. The novel also tackles deep existential questions of what it means to be thrown into being in the world, the terror and joys of existence, and especially the problem of being in a world that is under a state of potential destruction. A spoiler alert before we begin. In the last 10 minutes or so of our discussion, we discuss the final denouement of the novel and the conclusion. So if you have not read the novel and want to preserve that mystery, you should switch off before the last 10 minutes. Anna Richards, welcome to Countersign. Thanks for joining me. I was fascinated to read Marlene Haushofer's The Wall, which was first published in German with the title Die Wand in 1963. How did you first come across or hear about this novel?
I've been aware of the existence of this novel for some time because I'm working German studies, but I'd heard of it largely as a science fiction novel or as a kind of fairy tale. And neither of those genres particularly appealed to me. And so I only actually read the novel much more recently in the context of my work on critical animal studies. And what I discovered when I read it was that it really isn't a science fiction novel, although there are elements of that. It's really a very realist novel about the kind of prosaic, mundane details of everyday life. I think Doris Lessing said that only a woman could have written this book, and I really understand that comment because it seems to me a very feminized world that the author's portraying.
You started by saying that you had heard that it was a sort of fairy tale, and so, you know, that didn't appeal to you immediately, and then there was a sense that it was science fiction, but also that it's a novel that resonates very heavily with feminists and eco-feminists in particular. So let's start by saying a little bit about the plot. What happens at the outset?
It's written in the first person by a woman who we learn is around the age of 40, who's gone to stay with her cousin and her cousin's husband in a hunting lodge in the Austrian Alps. The first morning that she's there, she wakes up and she realizes that her cousin and her husband haven't returned from a trip that they went on the night before to an inn. And so she sets out exploring to find out what's happened and comes across an invisible wall, which has appeared, or rather not appeared, apparently cutting her off from the rest of the world on the other side, and apparently killing all the living creatures on the other side of the wall. So the novel is really an account of what happens next when she tries to survive alone in the mountains. And I say alone, but actually, although she has no other human company, a really central part of the novel is the fact that she has the company of various animals, a dog in particular, a cat and a cow, and their offspring. And the rest of the novel is a kind of detailed account of day-to-day life, subsistence farming, how she plants and harvests crops, how she cuts wood, how she cares for the animals, explores other parts of the mountains, and the various ups and downs in the course of their lives, including the birth of various offspring, the deaths of various animals, her kind of existential dilemmas, various trips that she makes to another part of the mountain, which is called the Alm, which is a kind of high mountain pasture where she goes in the summertime to graze, allow the animals to graze.
Okay, so that's great. As a sort of brief outline, and we'll come to more detail shortly, how does she first encounter the wall? Because as you said, it's an invisible wall. So how does she come upon it and then come to grasp the scale of it and what it means for her?
She sets out to find out where everybody is, and with the dog, Lynx. Mm-hmm. And it's Lynx, the dog, that first comes across the wall. He bumps into it. And so then she also tries to explore and find out what's happening, comes up against the wall, doesn't, of course, immediately realise what it is or what it represents. And that's a dawning realisation. But I think it's also really important to notice that there's, in a sense, a lack of curiosity and consideration on her part of exactly what the wall is or what it represents. So very quickly, within a couple of days, she sort of accepts the fact that there is some wall there dividing her from the rest of the world, and now she just has to get on with it.
And she can see through the wall. So one very important part of this, of course, is, I mean, I imagined it when I first read it as a sort of glass dome. And glass is, because the dog Lynx runs into it, clearly can't see it, hurts his mouth and starts bleeding. There's a sense in which I thought of it as a sort of glass, or at least a transparent object. You can see through it. And she can see people across the other side who are dead. So that's the other part of the sense in which it ought to invoke some kind of terror. You know, apart from being, you know, trapped inside, she also encounters a destruction of all other living things on the other side, apart from plants and trees, etc.
Yes, that's right. She sees a man and his wife sitting outside a cottage on the other side, apparently frozen in action, in mid-action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, so in order to get the texture of the novel, I think it's really important, and you're going to read a few extracts from the novel. So would you like to begin by reading the first extract?
Okay. Once, it must have been in the first winter, I saw a fox standing, drinking at the stream. It was clad in its greyish-brown winter coat, covered with a layer of whitish frost. In the sleepy silence of the snowy landscape, it looked very much alive. I could have shot it. I had the gun with me, but I didn't do it. Pearl had to die just because one of her ancestors was an overbred Angora cat. From the start, she had been destined as a victim for foxes, owls, and martens. Was I to punish the beautiful living fox for that? Pearl had suffered an injustice, but that same injustice had also befallen her victims, the trout. Was I to pass it on to the fox? The only creature in the forest that can really do right or wrong is me, and I alone can show mercy. Sometimes I wish that burden of decision-making didn't lie with me, but I'm a human being, and I can only act and think like a human being. Only death will free me from that. Whenever I think winter, I always see the white, frost-covered fox standing by the snow-covered stream, a lonely adult animal going his predetermined way. Then it seems that this image means something important to me, as if it's only a sign for something else, but I can't get to the meaning of it.
Okay, so there's a lot in here about the difference between humans and animals, and we'll come to talking about that shortly. But I think the other thing to say before we set out on that discussion is that there's a retrospective writing taking place here, isn't there? So
yeah.
She's writing a journal after these events have taken place, and she's recounting them. So do you want to say a little bit about how she goes about that process and the form of the novel, really?
Yeah, so she says that she's writing the novel about 2.5 years after the wall first appears, and she says that she's writing her report, as she calls it, in order to maintain her sanity, because otherwise she's going to go mad and she has nobody else to talk to. And she makes it very clear from the beginning of the novel, actually, that she's writing in response to a loss, the loss being the death of her dog, Lynx, who's become her companion. And so, yes, throughout the novel, we have this sort of switching between contemporary reflections that she's making at the time of writing on her condition and accounts set in the past as they're happening.
Mm-hmm. And in extract that you've just read, there's a recounting of her encounter with this fox, which says something here about the relative power that she has in relation to animals. And she has these feelings of revenge in relation to the fox. What does the novel say about this relative power between humans and animals?
So this is one of the most fascinating parts of the novel, because in some senses, it's a prolonged kind of investigation, elaboration on this theme. What divides us from animals? What doesn't divide us from animals? And there are moments in the novel when she feels like this boundary, which has, you know, traditionally been set up between human and animals, is entirely dissolved, particularly in her relationship with Lynx, to whom she feels very close and who seems to understand everything she's saying, who picks up on her moods. However, on the other hand, she has these sort of jarring realizations at other moments that she can't escape humanity as much as she would like to. We see that here. She actually, and I think this is the really radical thing about the novel, that actually rather than celebrating this concept of human exceptionalism, as, you know, has often been done, we possess language, we possess reason, we possess the power to make moral decisions, she experiences that largely as a burden, and she experiences it as something that actually is not going to make much difference to the world anyway. There's even a kind of almost at moments nihilistic desire to die herself and for the entirety of humanity to die with her. And that doesn't particularly seem like the end of the world to her, to use a bad pun. So yeah, it's very much about, I think there's one very interesting moment where she says, however hard I try, I can't just become an animal. And if I give up on all my kind of daily human routines, like cleaning my teeth, wearing clean clothes, getting up at the right time, making the bed, I won't just become an animal like them. I will fall beneath them into the abyss, she calls it. So there's this sort of, yeah, very strong sense that humanity is something that she would like to be able to escape, but she can't.
Mm. Yeah, there's a really strong sense. And, you know, I certainly experienced this myself in terms of my attachments to routine, that routine maintains a certain kind of psychological stability. That we humans need routines in order to cope with everything else that the world around us throws at us. So there is that experience of the difference between humans and animals. And for all we know, the animals themselves have their routines, you know, often interrupted by humans for their own ends. The other issue that gets thrown up in the passage you just read is this kind of sense of justice, the problem of justice, and how the problem of justice or right and wrong, which you might say is at the root of questions of justice, is posed in the passage. And And she concludes that she can't avenge Pearl and must just leave things be. And I think that's a real conundrum in terms of human encounters with nature. How much should humans intervene? How much should we do to set things right in the animal world, as it were? It's a question that props up a lot when animals are taken into account in legal theorization, for example. One of the things engaging with the novel is the importance of these themes that you've been identifying for the current moment in which we're living. So what do you think, you know, why does the novel resonate with us today? You know, it's a novel written by an Austrian woman in 1963 who, you know, grew up, was born in 1920, I think, you know, grew up in that interwar period. And what I gather from actually reading some of your research, had been influenced by Simone de Beauvoir and was very engaged with the condition of women in her time. Why does the novel speak to us today?
There are various themes, I think, which are very resonant today. And one of them, as you've kind of identified already, is the fact that it's such a feminist novel in many ways. The narrator talks about society before the war as a patriarchal one, which was hostile to women, and life on her own with no men around after the war is a kind of emancipation for her. And that, I still think, speaks to a lot of feminist themes today. And the novel was actually very enthusiastically sort of picked up and received by the second wave feminist move, almost rediscovered, if you like, then. The second obvious theme which resonates today is the environmental aspect. It's a kind of post-apocalyptic novel about how we live after environmental destruction. And it also relates, of course, another new way of relating to the environment and an appreciation of our interdependence with the environment. And then the theme that interests me most of all is surrounding the portrayal of animals and animal rights. On the one hand, of course, it's an examination of human relationships with animals. But on the other hand, I think it's a really interesting, if very tentative, attempt to explore animal subjectivity and what that might be like.
One of the things she obviously does is she sheds the very feminine features and characteristics that she has. And she engages with the everyday tending to the animals. So there is a sort of ethics of care that she brings to bear on her interactions with animals. But I was wondering, you know, can one just become more caring to animals, or does one have to go through some other process? In her case, she's isolated and there's nobody else. So it's partly that very strong isolation that forces her, in a sense, to interact with animals.
Yes, and there's another passage I think we're going to read later where she talks precisely about the fact that it's in these extreme kind of situations where people often discover some sort of intimacy with animals, for example, prisoners who tame rats in the prison. And she also says she'd always been very fond of animals in a kind of distant way that city people are fond of animals. So yes, there's certainly an implication that it's this kind of immersion in a very stark universe where there are no other human beings that allows this relationship to happen.
Mm-hmm. And just to flesh out her own sort of experience of this extreme space, this very unusual phenomenon of being cut off from the rest of the world and also not knowing what's happened to, you know, her daughters. She has two daughters. She's got no idea whether they're alive or dead, whether the mechanism or phenomenon that created the wall has also destroyed all other living things outside of the wall. Okay, so and this is also the time of the neutron bomb being invented. She publishes a novel around that period, and the neutron bomb was designed to kill living beings but leave infrastructure undamaged. So there is also this sort of sense of a technologically produced apocalypse that has potentially produced this isolation. But the isolation for her is a positive phenomenon, or it comes across, maybe positive is too strong, but what she certainly has is autonomy. And there's a sense reading the novel that this space becomes a zone of autonomy for her and for the animals. And that links, I think, to the ways in which feminists have taken up and eco-feminists have taken up the novel. So would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, she draws a very clear distinction between the masculine nature of society before the wall in post-war Austria. And this, of course, is Austria at the time of the economic miracle. She describes this kind of society as a car manufacturer's congress. That's the image that she uses, which is meant to suggest, of course, that its values are patriarchal, technological, consumerist. And those are the things largely which she's able to leave behind when she's living behind the wall. We have a kind of symbol of that in the novel with her cousin's husband's Mercedes, which is left outside the hunting lodge. And
that's right.
Something obviously that he's very proud of, this big flashy car. And gradually in the course of the novel, it's overrun by wildlife. Birds and mice make a nest in it. And this is a kind of symbol, obviously, of the kind of demise of technological culture. She is able to live in an apparently much more authentic, straightforward sort of way. She says at Christmas time, she doesn't have to run around the department stores buying presents that nobody wants. You mentioned her children earlier. I think that's really fascinating that this is someone whose ethics are based very largely on a sense of maternity. There are explicit references to the female reproductive system in relation to this ethics of care. Mm-hmm. And yet, when it comes to her actual children, of which, as you said, she has two, she seems entirely uninterested in them, the fact that they're probably dead. And she even says at one point, yeah, I'd stopped liking them really effectively. Right. They've become unlikable or something. Yeah,
yes.
since they became adolescents. So I do think there's a strange juxtaposition there, but I think possibly we're meant to understand that the kind of motherhood that she experienced before the war wasn't the kind of motherhood that she could potentially have experienced in a different environment, because she was so constrained by these pressures, technological, patriarchal, as I've said, social pressures.
And so I think that leads nicely to the ways in which the novel has been taken up by, or was taken up by, eco-feminist and pro-animal feminist advocates. There's a part of your own writing in relation to this that engages with how it is also a critique of the male animal rights discourse. So can you elaborate on the different kinds of discourses that feminist and other ethicists have brought to bear on animal rights?
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that when we're talking about those debates in animal rights philosophy, we're talking largely about debates which were taking place after the novel was written. In other words, kind of in the 1970s onwards, which is when the modern animal rights movement as we know it was born. And one of the things I find so striking then about the novel is that Haushofer is anticipating, I think, a lot of these debates a decade beforehand. So ecofeminists were largely critical of what they saw as the masculine bias of the animal rights philosophy of philosophers like Peter Singer and Tom Regan, which they argued were kind of rationalist philosophies, which ranked animals according to how like human beings they were. Hence, of course, the greater respect paid to great apes, for example, by thinkers such as Peter Singer, because they're much closer to human consciousness and their minds are much closer to ours. They argued that male animal rights philosophers tended to disavow the value of emotion and sentiment in our relationships with animals, that they relied on fairly abstract concepts of rights, autonomy, justice, whereas they were trying to promote a feminist care ethics, which is based on ideas of attachment, embodiedness, responsibility, and as I've said earlier, often included references, implicit or explicit, to maternity, a kind of maternal relationship to animals. And of course, they also were interested in particular in the intersection between the oppression of women and the oppression of non-human animals.
Mm-hmm. Now, we'll come to some of those themes in the next passage that we that you'll read as well. Now, there's a lot of detail in the novel of what we call nature. So there's cats, there's Lynx the dog, there's Bella the cow, Tiger the kitten, there's a bull, and there are deer. There's also considerable detail about sowing potatoes, beans, and the everyday work of the reproduction of life. Now, this is in stark contrast to the technological acceleration that was taking place at the time the novel was written. And it is worlds away from where many capitalist societies are now. So how does this novel then appeal so much to us today? What does it say about our current concern about nature that this sort of prosaic detail about the habits and movements of her cats, or the enormous attention and detailed effort that is needed to sow potatoes? You know, how does that appeal to us today?
I suppose the obvious answer there is that it's precisely our kind of distance from this kind of life that appeals to us, that there's a kind of nostalgia for the past, or a nostalgia for a kind of proximity to nature, for a simple life as we understand it. John Berger, of course, wrote in 1977 the essay Why Look at Animals, where he argued that it's precisely this kind of distance that we now have in more urban societies from animals that encourages us to try and sort of recuperate this loss in culture and also in zoos and in pet keeping. So there's certainly something of that going on here, I think. I do think it's important to underline, though, that this is, and you've mentioned this earlier, but this is really not an idealizing or kind of utopian novel. When I talk about this being regaining a kind of ideal of a simplified life, this is actually not, in some sense, what Haushofer is showing us at all. She's interested in the very hard work and the effort that a transition, if you like, to a kind of sustenance economy and or deacceleration after the Great Acceleration would involve. So it's as much in that sense a dystopia as it is a utopia.
And as you were speaking, I was starting to think also about, you know, degrowth capitalism that people are talking about today. And also the sense, just to emphasize this, that there's nothing simple about this life. It's in fact extremely arduous and involves an enormous amount of description of hard labor in order sustain her and the other animals she's with. And also the unpredictability, unpredictability and sacrifice that you have to, you know, you can't consume everything if you want to sow potatoes again the following year. And so you have to go without. And there's this real uncertainty about what might happen the next season, etc. Some of these themes, I think, also come out in the next extract that you're going to read.
November and the beginning of December were entirely taken up with work on the new buyer and concern about Bull and Bella. There could be no question of a peaceful winter. I've always been fond of animals, in the slight and superficial way in which city people feel drawn to them. When they were suddenly all I had, everything changed. There are said to have been prisoners who've tamed rats, spiders, and flies, and begun to love them. I think they acted in accordance with their situation. The barriers between animal and human come down very easily. We belong to a single great family, and if we're lonely and unhappy, we gladly accept the friendship of our distant relations. They suffer as we do if pain is inflicted on them, and like myself, they need food, warmth and a little tenderness. Incidentally, my affection has very little to do with understanding. In my dreams, I bring children into the world, and they aren't only human children. There are cats among them, dogs, calves, bears, and quite peculiar furry creatures. But they emerge from me, and there's nothing about them that could frighten or repel me. It only looks off-putting when I write it down, in human writing, and with human words. Perhaps I should draw these dreams with pebbles on green moss, or scratch them in the snow with a stick.
There's a real sense there of her struggling, almost at a sense of the limits of her own understanding of this being with animals, right? So she's really struggling to give an account of these friendships. Is that your sense there?
Yeah, that's something that comes up again and again in the novel. She's not trying to give us any absolute answers about what animals are like, what life living with animals is like. She often uses formulations like, oh, it seemed like Lynx, the dog, was thinking this, or it may be that the cow was understanding what I was saying. But she never expresses any absolutes.
You know, my sense from that passage is a real sense of hesitation that she has in representing or trying to capture and convey anything about the animals. I mean, there are her observations that are, you know, heartfelt and recorded, imbued with her feelings, but there's also a real care in not placing a sort of dominant, determinative narrative on who the animals are and what they're about. Is that your sense?
Yes, that's very much the case. She tries very hard in this novel not to give us any definitive answers about what human animals really think or feel, because of course that's something that we can never know. On the one hand, the novel is based, or was based on her part, on very extensive study of animal behaviour, and she consulted her brother, who was a forester, and she herself grew up the daughter of a forester. She observed her own animals. So I think there is a lot of actually very accurate detail. But on the other hand, then, when she does these sort of speculative leaps, imaginative leaps into animal psyche, she always caveats them with phrases like, I think, or it seemed like, or maybe he thought this, that, and the other, as a kind of attempt to avoid claiming any kind of absolute knowledge of what's really going on for animals.
Mm-hmm. And the passage there towards the end about writing, that she says, it only looks off-putting, these sorts of observations she has about giving birth to non-human children. It only seems off-putting when I write it down and put it in human words. So what's she trying to get at there about writing and literature and humans expressing themselves in the form of writing?
Mm. I think in that paragraph, there are two things going on. On the one hand, we have this idea that it's precisely in the realm of the imagination, fantasy, perhaps literature. Here it's a dream logic that she's talking about, which enables us better to understand animals and, as I say, to kind of imaginatively project ourselves into that world. And that's something perhaps that literature can do better than philosophy, for example, or other more rationalizing arguments or rational arguments. But she also then, of course, goes on to say, almost sort of takes back that initial suggestion by saying that when it comes to actually portraying these fantasies in words, human language is insufficient. And there's an awful lot as well in the novel, many, many hints we have that language, human language is insufficient. And I see a kind of parallel there, I guess, between the feminist argument that arose in the 1970s, 80s about language being phallocentric and incapable of expressing a female point of view. But how much more extreme then must language be incapable of expressing an animal perspective when animals are entirely without language? I think that's the point she's trying to make here.
Mm-hmm. I think the point about language is really important, and it resonated with me for a couple of reasons. One is the way in which I read The Wall as part of a Robinsonade. Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, of course, acted as a prototype for imperialism. An empire and had a very heavy civilizational discourse in it. And in Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, his man Friday, as the novel put it, was a subservient being. Now, in Robinson Crusoe has been taken up by many scholars and writers over the centuries, from Marx to Virginia Woolf to James Joyce to J.M. Coetzee. And in Coetzee's rewriting of the novel, one of the really intriguing aspects, and we won't be able to go into this in too much detail, Friday is deprived of language in Coetzee's novel Foe. And so I thought the care with which Haushofer approaches this problem of language and writing and expressing the relationship that the woman has with the animals really resonated with the care and attention we need to give to this rationalist mode that is often expressed through writing of securing an encounter with the other, with the abject, or with alterity. So I think this is another sort of set of themes that come out of the novel for me. And again, on the other hand, there's nothing romantic about being with animals, right? So the animals, on the one hand, there's this kind of fantasy about or a dreamlike fantasy of, or dreams she has giving birth to animals or furry things. And on the other hand, actually, they're really the other as well. She can't. Mm. Yeah, she can't really commune with them. How does Haushofer cope with that?
Yeah, there's a lot in the novel about her trying to come to terms with this sense of isolation and reflecting in a very melancholy way on the people on the other side of the wall who've died. The writing of the diary in the first place is an attempt to overcome this sort of isolation. And she says she's not sure that anyone is ever going to read it, but it still brings her something, a sense of sort of communication, mental stability in order to be able to write it at all. But I also think that there's a sense in which Haushofer is arguing against this idea, which she might perhaps characterize as a kind of masculine idea, that there's something pure about isolation which allows us to reflect more authentically on social and political existential questions. And actually what she's arguing is that it's the sort of day-to-day messiness and entanglement of relationships, in this case with animals, in which one actually finds the meaning of life.
Now, we've just talked about isolation that being a key part of the novel. There's also an ongoing sense of dread she may not be alone.
Spoiler alert.
A stranger comes upon the cottage and first kills Lynx, her dog, and then the bull. I'll leave you to tell us how she deals with that. But in your you've discussed this arrival of the intruder. So what do you make of that?
The conclusion to the novel is often read as a particularly shocking or incongruent aspect of the novel. So she's up on the Alm, actually, on the kind of high mountain pasture. She sees this intruder. He's killed Lynx. He's killed the bull with an axe. She immediately goes to get her rifle and shoots him dead. She also, there's no sense of regret or reflection about that afterwards. She leaves his body, she kicks his body down the hill, that's right. Lynx the dog, however, she buries under his favourite spot. She mourns him. A lot of the novel actually is written in response to the loss of Lynx. And so I always find it surprising that readers are so shocked by this conclusion, which I think they read as a kind of embracing of violence or use of violence in a novel which is meant to be about an ethics of care and a kind of disavowal of violence, perhaps. Death isn't new at all in this novel. We've had several characters, non-human characters, who've died already. And those aren't just people who've died naturally, but also deer whom she has killed, something which she battles with. It's a very unidealizing portrait of nature and of survival. And she's already also made it clear to us that she's much fonder of non-human than she is of human animals, that she's really glad that no men have actually survived, because were there to be a real man, human man, who'd survived, he doubtless would have tried to subjugate her. Mm-hmm. So when this sort of violent, apparently disturbed man appears from nowhere and brutally kills two of her animal family, I think that's only more shocking a conclusion than her hunting of the deer, which has gone before that, if we're still reading this from an anthropocentric point of view.
Okay, let's read the next passage.
There's no escape, for as long as there's something for me to love in the forest, I shall love it. And if someday there's nothing, I shall stop living. If everyone had been like me, there would never have been a war. But I understand why the others always have the upper hand. Loving and looking after another creature is a very troublesome business, and much harder than killing and destruction. It takes 20 years to bring up a child, and 10 seconds to kill it. It took the bull a year to grow big and strong, and a few strokes of an axe were enough to dispatch him. I think about the long time that Bella carried him patiently in her body, the arduous hours of his birth, and the long months during which he grew from a little calf to a big bull. The sun had to shine and grow the grass for him. Water had to spring from the earth and fall from the sky to slake his thirst. He had to be combed and brushed, and his dung had to be cleared away so that he could lie in a dry bed. And it had all been in vain. I can only see it as a hideous muddle and extravagance. Perhaps the person who killed him was mad, but even his madness betrayed him. The secret wish to murder must have been dormant within him. I'm even inclined to pity his state of mind. But again and again, I try to obliterate him from my memory, because it's unbearable to think that someone like that could go on murdering and destroying. I don't think anyone else of his kind is living in the forest, but I've become as suspicious as my cat. My rifle always hangs loaded on the wall, and I never set foot outside the house without my sharp jackknife. I've given these things a great deal of thought, and perhaps I've reached the point where I can even understand even murderers. Their hate for everything capable of creating new life must be terrible.
So the first sense I get from this passage is about the prevalence in many cultures, especially in the Western world, but not only in the Western world, of animals being reared and cared for, but primarily for human consumption. And more often than not, it's in factory farms, and they are murdered in their billions. Now, the woman in the novel also confronts this problem, but there is a proliferation of the consumption of animals as food. And there's been a podcast on Countersign recently where I've discussed that with Dinesh Wadiwal. What can we take from the novel in relation to this problem of rearing and caring for and then killing animals for human consumption?
She makes reference to this when she talks about the fact that because of the war, bull is not being sent to the slaughterhouse like he otherwise would be. And then, of course, the irony is that he is indeed killed in the end, as we learn in this passage. I think that on the one hand, of course, this passage is interesting because it's such a feminized passage. As I've said before, it really shows that the moral message here is a gendered one. Women are involved in giving birth, in the work of labor, of pregnancy, then of caring for animals largely. And the act of destruction, of killing them, is coded here as a masculine one. What we can take from the novel, I guess, is a kind of reflection on factory farming. I think is this very strong sense we get in the novel as animals mattering as individuals. And that's something I think that can get lost often. And that's what literature, of course, allows us to do, because we're learning who these people are as characters. I say people, I mean non-human people. And I wonder if that's also, we talked about the environmental debate earlier, I wonder if that's also something that this novel can feed into the environmental debate, that there occasionally also environmental problems are discussed in terms of species, in terms of species more being, the extinction of a species being much more important, for example, than the death of millions of factory animals. And this perhaps often, not always, but anthropocentric emphasis on the environment as mattering because we need to leave it to our children and our grandchildren. What Haushofer is asking us to do, I think, is a really sort of radical equalizing of all living creatures, whether that be a farm animal, a cow, a calf, or whether that be a deer or wildlife, or indeed a species that's about to go extinct.
No, I think that's a really important insight, actually, about the radical equalizing of animals, and that comes through the novel very strongly. The extract that you've just read is also it also brings out a theme that you've discussed in your article about the novel, that it provokes this sort of Heideggerian sense of being thrown into the world. And it's not only humans, you know, the humans are initially children and animals. They're also thrown into the world, and they encounter this thrownness differently, that joy and terror is a condition of being thrown in the world. That's something that I think resounds through this passage, that being thrown into the world resounds with terror and possibility. Would you like to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, she actually departs from Heidegger in one respect there, that Heidegger argues that animals, because they aren't aware of their approaching death, don't experience an authentic death. He describes it as a verendung, a kind of just coming to an end. And she reverses that argument and suggested that because they don't have the capacity to reflect, to distract themselves from ideas of death, the true death is that experienced by animals, perhaps also by young children, as well as the fact that they also have a much more direct experience of beauty and wonder, the wonder of nature. And this is a theme actually which Haushofer comes back to in other works that she's written, this idea that certain experiences are really only accessible in their immediacy to children or to animals. And there are moments in the novel where she's trying to recapture that. For example, when she goes up to the Alm and she feels a great oneness with nature and a kind of immediacy, a oneness with the environment. She's looking at the moon and the stars. But she also experiences that state as threatening and undermining, because she almost thinks experiences a kind of dissolution of the self, and she wants to hang on to a kind of an ordered sense of reason in order to be able to carry on caring for her animals and farming and harvesting. I think in an existential sense, we definitely have a depiction of somebody trying to come to terms with a perceived meaninglessness or absurdity in the environment. And this, of course, is a really extreme example of a existentialist situation in which we're all okay in a world that we don't understand. But she, more than anyone, is in a world which is entirely inexplicable, because she has no idea, as we've said, what the wall is, why it's there, or what's happening to her. And her solution to it, in a way, is almost to sidestep or ignore the existential or the element of meaning, and to embrace a kind of local hope or a kind of local responsibility for her immediate family, the animals, for her actions. She hopes at the end of the novel, despite all the tragedies that have befallen her, she's looking forward to Bella possibly having another calf. There's a white crow that sits outside the lodge that she's going to go and feed. And she sees this sort of caring, this sort of one foot in front of the other philosophy, I think, as the answer for her. Haushofer's biography, Daniela Striegel, has described her as a female Sisyphus. And I think that's really interesting, you know, in the sense of Camus' Sisyphus, who sort of knows that this is an absurd action and yet manages to keep doing it again every day. although I think Camus describes Sisyphus as, we have to assume that Sisyphus is happy. And there's not a lot of happiness in this novel. There's a lot of melancholy for Haushofer. And yet she keeps emotionally investing.
Mm. No, that's a terrific, summation of where we get to at the end of the novel. I particularly love that rendering of feeding the white crow who obviously, you know, by virtue of being white, stands out, is ostracized by the other crows. And so there's this attentiveness to the local, as you said, without some other grander scheme to orient her actions. So Anna Richards, that's been a terrific conversation to have with this incredibly thought-provoking novel, which I know is being read in various philosophy departments and literature departments. And I hope, through this podcast and through your work and other forms of dissemination, will get more attention. It certainly helped me to think about many of the challenges that we're currently facing in relation to climate destruction and war. And you've really helped us to think more deeply about what the novel has to offer. Thank you, Anna.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.